This is GraceNetRadio.com.
Welcome to Vocal Point on GraceNetRadio.com. Each week, we will examine issues that concern all Christians living in today's culture. Politics, theology, world affairs, citizenship, ethics, and personal responsibility. And now, your host of Vocal Point, Jerry Newcomb on GraceNetRadio.com.
And good afternoon. Do you know the fascinating story about St. Valentine? Well, we're going to talk about that with Bill Federer coming up at 12:30. Plus, we'll be focusing on the issue of Christians and history, an interesting perspective there. But our first half, we have quite a privilege to talk with one of my all-time favorite guests here. His name is Dr. Stephen Meyer, and he's written a book called Darwin's Doubt, a New York Times best-selling book. And he is someone who helps as a kind of a resident scientist here, helps put things in perspective. Recently, there was a story just this week where Democratic House members attempted to settle scientific debates and establish a day honoring Charles Darwin. Three House Democrats have attempted to settle the ongoing scientific debates about Darwinian evolution and global warming by congressional fiat. This resolution represents a clear example of ideological posturing and congressional overreach, said Stephen Meyer, author of the New York Times best-selling book, Darwin's Doubt. Well, let's see if we can get Dr. Meyer back on the line here. He is with the Discovery Institute. He earned his Ph.D. at Cambridge University in England. And Dr. Meyer is so knowledgeable about all things scientific. In fact, he's one of the great theorists on the subject of intelligent design. In fact, if you saw that classic movie with Ben Stein, the movie called Expelled, Dr. Meyer was one of those who was in that movie. Darwin's Doubt, by the way, is a great book. It is all about how Darwin was thinking as he postulated his theory that there was a problem that he found even in his day in the fossil record. The problem is used with the name today of the Cambrian explosion. In Darwin's day, it wasn't called that. But his thinking was, look, okay, I see that at a certain level in the fossil record, all these different organisms appear abruptly. That's a problem for his theory, as opposed to the idea of chronicling the fossils, chronicling evolution in process, one creature, in a sense, evolving slowly over time into another creature. That's not what you find in the fossil record, and it certainly wasn't what they found in the fossil record even in Charles Darwin's day. But his thinking was, keep digging, I will be vindicated. And if not, my theory is kaput. He even says as such, I'm obviously paraphrasing, in his classic book, 1859, On the Origin of the Species. Well, here we are more than 150 years after digging, 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 and more digging of fossils all over the world. And instead of vindicating Darwin's theory of macroevolution, instead what we find is that the problem of abrupt appearances is that much worse and harder to explain. So in Darwin's day, he had the honesty to have Darwin's doubt. Today, it's a full-scale unbelief, if you will, in Darwinian evolution. But you wouldn't know that today because the cultural elite, including those that control so many of our schools today and our universities and museums and all sorts of different places. And here we even see some congressional leaders taking the side of dogmatic Darwinianism. Well, Darwin's Doubt by Stephen Meyer, this best-selling book, New York Times best-selling book, by the way, definitely shows Darwin's Doubt and puts it in perspective. Dr. Meyer, it's great to have you back on the program.
Hey, Jerry, it's always good to talk.
Sure. Before I get right into this news item about Democratic House members trying to attempt to settle scientific debates and establish the day honoring Charles Darwin, which I guess is what, February 15th? They want to call
February
it
February 12th, right.
February 12th,
yeah.
I'm sorry, Darwin's Day. Wasn't he born the exact same day as Abraham Lincoln?
the exact same day and the exact same year as Abraham Lincoln.
1809, yeah. Then.
Yeah.
Okay, wow, interesting. Summarize for us, in a few sentences or a few paragraphs, if you wish, Darwin's doubt, the book itself. What was the doubt that Darwin had? I tried to summarize it, but you'll do it much better than I did.
Sure. Well, he had a doubt that he expressed right in The Origin of Species about the ability of his theory to explain a particular event in the history of life known as the Cambrian explosion. And the Cambrian explosion is that point in the history of life as documented in the geological record in which the major groups of animals come suddenly into the fossil record, into the sedimentary layers. And they do so very abruptly, and this was quite in contrast to what Darwin expected. He thought that the fossil record should show the gradual morphing of simpler forms of life and simpler forms of animal life into the complex forms that we first see in the Cambrian period. But instead of arising in that slow, gradual evolutionary fashion, we see them arising geologically very suddenly, and that troubled him. And he said that the evidence of this explosion of animal life was a valid objection to the views here entertained in his book. And what I do in the book Darwin's Doubt is I not only describe that the doubt that he had in the first chapter of the book, but then I trace that doubt. I tell the story of what's happened to it and how it's grown up to be illustrative of a major crisis in modern evolutionary theory. It's the Cambrian explosion isn't just a matter of the missing fossils. It's an engineering problem. How would the evolutionary process ever build such complex forms of life in the time allowed, especially now that we know that building new forms of animal life requires reams and reams of digital code stored in the DNA molecule and other forms of biological information? And that's the real problem. Where does the information come from that's necessary to build complex forms of life?
All right, let me ask you a what-if question, totally hypothetical here, but what if Charles Darwin were a completely honest man and he were to come back, or not come back, but rather come to our time, examine the evidence that we have, even evidence that you point out in your book, Darwin's Doubt, would he abandon Darwinian evolution as an honest man?
Yeah, as a completely honest man, well, I suppose probably he would. Although it's really hard to speculate about what an historical figure would say when confronted with what we know that he didn't know. But one thing that I think is interesting about Darwin and his legacy is that in contrast to the modern defenders of neo-Darwinism, Darwin was rhetorically modest. He acknowledged difficulties. Mm-hmm. And I've had experiences in these public controversies about what to teach in the public schools where you find really dogmatic people on the other side, and in many cases, prominent people. You have, I testified at the State Board of Education hearing in 2009 in the great state of Texas, and the board there was considering adopting proposals that would encourage teachers to teach the strengths and weaknesses of competing scientific theories. And the Darwin only science education lobby showed up in force and said, hey, you can't apply that standard, that proposal to Darwinian evolution, because as Eugenie Scott of the National Center for Science Education said at the time, evolutionary theory has no weaknesses. Mm-hmm. And I think the kind of bravado and overconfidence and posturing that you see in the Darwin lobby today is very much different than what you saw even in Darwin's writing of The Origin of Species. He was much more modest and willing to acknowledge evidential difficulties, and I think if he were alive today, he would have to acknowledge the problem that I address in Darwin's Doubt, the problem of the origin of information, because the mutation selection mechanism just doesn't have the creative power to generate new lines of code.
Do the Darwin-only people of today, do they embrace Darwin as Darwin presented himself, or do they embrace, in a sense, an evolved form of Darwinism?
Well, it is an evolved form of Darwinism, but it stands in the stream of Darwinian thought. Darwin emphasized the role of natural selection acting on random variations, but he didn't really have a theory of genetics, and he didn't know about genes, and therefore he didn't know about DNA, and he didn't know about mutations in DNA. So modern neo-Darwinists talk about natural selection acting on random mutations, which are essentially copying errors in DNA, and that is what they think is the creative engine driving the evolutionary process. But if you stop and think about that for a minute, it's kind of an implausible proposal now that we understand that DNA contains information in a digital form. Along the spine of the DNA molecule, there are four chemicals called bases, and the arrangement of those bases conveys information for building all the proteins and protein machines that cells need to stay alive. Now, if you start altering digital information in a random way, think of a section of software, and think of changing the zeros and ones randomly
without respect
to the outcome, you're going to degrade the information that you have there far before you'll come up with anything new or useful.
Sure.
And the same problem occurs with a vengeance when you're talking about the random mutation to the digital code in DNA. So I think many scientists doubt that that is a plausible mechanism for generating all the new complex forms of life we see. And I think that, so it is a different form of, the modern form of Darwinism is quite similar to Darwin's theory, but I think it's implausible at its crucial point in that the mechanism lacks the creative power necessary to do all the wonderful things that Darwinians say it does.
Does the theory itself imply that the changes that, let's say, okay, they say, evolutionists say, that man and ape came from the same species way back when. Not that man evolved from ape, but rather man and ape evolved from some sort of hominid
common
or something.
Ancestor, right.
Yeah, some sort of common ancestor way back when. The difference between that common ancestor and, let's say, man, or even ape, which would probably obviously be more evolved according to their theory, right? Was the difference caused by some sort of mutation? And if that's the case, how is it that a mutation would result in something positive as opposed to something negative? Aren't mutations virtually always harmful?
Well, they are virtually always harmful, and of course the view would be that there would be an accumulation of mutations over a long period of time. The supposed human and chimp divergence from a common ancestor is thought to be about 5.5 million years ago, so it would be a question of the number of mutations that could accumulate over that amount of time. There's a couple of problems, and I address both of these in Darwin's Doubt with relying on mutations, however, to generate fundamental innovations in the history of life. One is that not all mutations are equal. If you want to have mutations that fundamentally alter the body plan of an organism, you've got to have those mutations need to occur very early in the process of embryological development, going from fertilized egg to adult form. Because the way embryological development works is that you have one cell divides into two, into four, into eight, into 16, and unless you get the mutations acting very early, they're not going to affect all the other cells downstream, and therefore they're not going to affect the whole architecture of the animal. So the kind of mutations you need are early acting body plan mutations, but the experimental evidence shows that those are the very kind of mutations that are always lethal. It's a well-known problem known as embryonic lethals. So people like to wave their hands and say, treat mutations as a kind of magic bullet. But it depends on what kind of mutations as to whether or not they're even plausibly beneficial. And then there's a further problem, and this has come up specifically in relation to the human chimp divergence. It turns out that if you need coordinated mutations to produce a given structure, and many, many, even small changes in the history of life would require coordinated mutations involving several parts of the DNA changing in a coordinated way. If you need coordinated mutations, the waiting times that are associated with those kinds of events are far beyond what's available to the evolutionary process, even assuming what's called evolutionary deep time, hundreds of millions of years or more. And Michael Behe made some calculations about this in a book called The Edge of Evolution, showing that if you needed two or more coordinated mutations in the hominid line, it would require hundreds of millions of years beyond the presumed time of the chimp-human divergence. Two mathematical biologists at Cornell said that can't be right, and they came back and made their own calculations. And whereas Behe said it was well over 500 million years that it would take to accumulate a couple of coordinated mutations in the hominid line, these guys came back and said, "Well, Behe's wrong. It would only take 216 million years." But that made the point moot because there's only the presumed divergence is only 5 million years ago. So another problem is that even on the scale of hundreds of millions or billions of years, the mutation selection mechanism doesn't have the time necessary to it to generate complex, what are called complex adaptations, structures that require more than two or more coordinated mutations. And that's a mathematical problem with the theory that I discuss in Darwin's Doubt, and which Michael Behe has done just a terrific job of exposing in some of the work that he's done, both in his book, The Edge of Evolution, and some of the technical papers he's written.
All right, let's see. First of all, let me say this for those who may have just joined us. We're talking right now with Dr. Stephen Meyer, author of the book Darwin's Doubt. Little commercial here, darwinsdoubt.org for more information. Don't worry about the apostrophe. Is there any other website you want to note? Maybe evolutionnews.org?
Evolutionnews.org is great, and Darwin's Doubt is actually a .com.
So oh, I'm sorry.
Type in .org, they're going to get disappointed.
But, okay.
And I should mention that the young techies at our office here have created a wonderful YouTube channel associated with the darwinsdoubt.com website.
Oh,
so there's lots of debates and videos and animations. In particular, a wonderful animation called Journey Inside the Cell that helps people see exactly how the information in DNA is directing the construction of all these wonderful parts inside cells. And there's also debates. I know there's a lot of interest right now because of the big debate that was at the Creation Museum.
Right, Ken Ham versus Bill Nye.
Right, and we would have framed that debate a little differently, and people that are have been asking us what issues we'd have focused on, and you can see some of the recent debates that I've done there on that same website, darwinsdoubt.com. So lots of good info.
But now, what do you say if somebody accused you, okay, Dr. Meyer, you're really not a scientist or a philosopher of science in the sense that you have your Christian convictions, which are derived from the Bible, so you have your mind made up, and then as you approach science, you want to go ahead and come up with your own predetermined conclusion, and therefore we, the evolutionists, shouldn't listen to you. What would you say to that?
Well, I think you can always accuse somebody else of having motives, and of course everyone has motives, but the question as a scientist or as a philosopher or a philosopher of science is this: when you're making an argument, are your presuppositions functioning as premises in the argument? In other words, are you assuming the point at issue, or are you using evidence that's independent to establish your point? And in Darwin's Doubt and in Signature in the Cell, my two books, I take great pains to argue the case for intelligent design based on the evidence, not based on a prior commitment to a theistic worldview, or in my case, I am a biblical Christian, so I'm not bringing the Bible in as a premise in the argument, saying, "Well, this is true because the Bible says so," or because I'm assuming that there is a designer, or assuming that there is a God. Instead, I'm looking at the evidence and then evaluating it using a standard method of scientific reasoning. In fact, the very method that Darwin himself used, and allowing our experience of the world to dictate whether or not we all should find the Darwinian mechanism an adequate explanation for the origin of the information you'd need to build these animals, or whether the evidence that we have of the way the world works suggests that an intelligent designer is a better explanation. I argue for the second point, and I do so based on the experience of the world around us. We know from experience that it always takes a mind or an intelligent agent to generate information, whether we're looking at information in a software code or in a book or in a hieroglyphic inscription. When we trace information back to its source, we always come to an intelligence not an undirected material process. That's not a conclusion derived from reading scripture or from a prior set of philosophical beliefs. That's a conclusion derived from observing the way the world works, what it actually takes to generate information. So I'm not begging the question or assuming the point at issue by bringing my worldview in as a premise in the argument.
Now, if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you, since I have the privilege of talking to you from time to time on the radio, and I really enjoy these chats, did you ever, in your personal life, embrace Darwinian evolution?
Well, you know, that is another point I was going to make, that, but I always repair to the philosophical and logical point first. But just as a matter of my own personal history, when I graduated from college with two science degrees, one in physics and one in geology, and went to work as a geophysicist in the oil industry. And at that time in my life, I was, I guess you'd probably describe me as a theistic evolutionist. It took me a long time to become convinced of Christianity. I had a long, tortuous conversion that took about 6 or 7 years before I was really settled in my faith. But even when I first came to a settled conviction that Christianity was true, I was pretty convinced of the evolutionary approach to things. That was the approach that I learned in my science classes. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't later until I started thinking about this problem of the origin of information, having encountered some of the scientists who were first making the case for intelligent design, a chemist named Charles Thaxton in particular had a big influence on opening my mind to this possibility, that I began to consider the possibility that the evolutionary approach was insufficient, at least in respect to this really big important question, which is, how did the information arise that's necessary to build the first living cell? How did the information arise that's necessary to build new forms of life from simpler pre-existing forms? So, yeah, I was changed from a what you might call a theistic evolutionary position to a intelligent design view by the evidence, not by religious considerations, because I was religious before, you know, in I was a Christian before and after I changed to intelligent design. What changed my view was really the thinking about this really important new class of evidence.
Well, you know, it's interesting because even like right now, I can think of Richard Dawkins is probably the leading evolutionist that's alive today, and yet he has actually admitted on film, when he was interviewed by Ben Stein in the movie Expelled, he's basically said, well, look, the cell of the human body is so complicated that it absolutely had to have been designed. But as, you know, Ben Stein presses him, essentially he believes it was designed by some sort of alien from outer space that then planted those seeds here in America. I mean, not in America, but, you know, on planet Earth or something like that. And that's just like, wow, that's so weird. But in a sense, isn't he saying, the leading evolutionist, that effectively he does believe in intelligent design because the evidence here points to that intelligent design?
Well, I think in the interview, he was entertaining the idea as a possibility.
Okay.
I don't think he would. Now he's been very embarrassed by having said those things, and now he would probably want to pull back from him. And he was talking about not so much the cells in the human body, but the origin of the very first cell. And Ben Stein in the interview was sharp enough to ask him about that question because he knew that the evolutionary theorists are quite aware that they do not have an adequate explanation of the origin of the first life. In other words, how do you get from simple chemicals to a first cell? That's a big jump. And people have been trying since just the immediate decades after Darwin to come up with a theory of what's called chemical evolution that could explain the origin of the first life. And really, there is no adequate theory. And that's what my first book, Signature in the Cell, was all about. Mm. And so, of course, when I was watching the interview in the theater, my ears just absolutely perked up when Dawkins said, you know, well, it could be that there's a signature of intelligence inside the cell. But my working title was Signature in the Cell, and that's, of course, the title of the book now. But when I heard him say that, I thought, well, now, wait a minute, where's he going with this? And then he did. He shocked us all by saying, well, but, you know, that signature of intelligence might have been produced by an intelligent being. But then he said, but it would have to have been a being that itself evolved somewhere else in the cosmos. And Ben later called that the ABG theory, anything but God.
Yeah.
You know? But it is interesting, first of all, that Dawkins would make such a public admission of the inability of evolutionary theorists to come up with a theory of the origin of life. I know that that's the case because I've worked in the field. But secondly, that he would speculate about the need for intelligence, and of course he's tried to walk some of that back. But I think if you see digital code, the most natural thing to conclude is that the code had an intelligent source, a program. Bill Gates said that DNA is like a software program, but more complex than any we've ever created. Programs come from programmers, and information generally, as I argued a minute ago, yep, always arises from an intelligent source. And even Dawkins has been willing to entertain that possibility.
Well, and I think the bottom line is when you look at the probability that, let's say, life could have just, you know, happened from non-life, the odds are so much against it. It's just, you know, it'd be like if a casino had such odds against you ever winning there, that casino would close up after a day or two because
no one would want to play because
they would never win ever.
Sometimes people ask me, you know, is it possible to make a lottery that's so improbable that in all probability no one will ever win? And the answer to that question is actually yes. And the lottery of life is just such a thing. In all probability, it is much more probable than not that the evolutionary process would never generate even a single new protein in the known time of life on Earth than it is. It's more probable that wouldn't happen than that it ever would, and vastly more probable that the evolutionary process would fail to generate even a single known protein. So, and I run through this in Darwin's Doubt and explain the reasoning behind this. Generating even the information necessary to build some of the smallest fundamental units, functional units in life, is immensely beyond the capacities of the natural selection mutation mechanism. And that's really the critical issue.
So what is your thought about some politicians saying, hey, it's time we honor Darwin and recognize that the science is in, the science is settled, Darwinism is true. Oh, and by the way, there's also global warming.
Yeah, well, right. I mean, this is a classic example of ideological posturing and congressional overreach. You got three Democratic congressmen in the House who want to declare February 12th Darwin's Day, and they, with that, want to promulgate a statement lionizing Darwin and his theory and basically saying that their statement says that natural selection and random mutation provides a really credible explanation for the origin of and complexity of life, and they go on to say that the science of genetics supports this. And we were just talking, of course, about how the problem of genetic information is the Achilles heel of neo-Darwinism. So the ignorance of the statement is breathtaking, and it got my attention for that reason, since I've just written a book about how the modern version of Darwin's theory can't explain precisely the origin of genetic information. But then they also go on to say that, you know, we also have to protect people from skepticism about human-caused global warming, that any doubts about global warming are anti-scientific. And I think repeatedly politicians and media people and spokesmen for science are making this same error, which is that they equate a specific scientific theory like Darwinian evolution or global warming with the practice of science itself, such that they regard any criticism of those theories as being anti-science, when in fact scientists are supposed to be involved in critically evaluating scientific theories and need to have the freedom to do so.
Exactly. And again, the book that Dr. Stephen Meyer has written is called Darwin's Doubt, New York Times best-selling book. Congratulations on that fact again, and thank you so much for being with us. Keep up the great work. DarwinsDoubt.com for more information, and there's no apostrophe. Thank you again, Stephen Meyer.
Thank you, Jerry. It's always fun to talk.
Okay. God bless. All right. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
And we were just talking about that notion of Darwin's Day. Well, when we come back, we will talk about St. Valentine's Day with best-selling author Bill Federer, and we'll also talk in general about Christianity and history. This is Jerry Newcomb on Focal Point. We'll be back in a moment with more.